28, the font? Or you can, I guess you can zoom the thing at 200, right? But in case I mention things that won't be familiar to people, I sometimes type as it crosses my mind, so you see what I'm talking about.
There you go.
Okay, first of all, let me thank the organizers for inviting me to this. I'm not sure I'm the most natural person for this conference. I'm a professional academic. I'm professor of sociology at the University of Warwick. I've spoken at three sort of multimedia digital art events in this city alone. And I guess the most interesting thing that I can bring to the table here today is the fact that we are considering at Warwick the idea of general education for all incoming undergraduate students. Now, for those of you who aren't from the United States, it's quite common in the United States for students to only major after their second of a four-year undergraduate degree. And so they have the first year or two actually to sample many different courses across the curriculum. And this is called general education. This is not very common, not in this country nor in Europe, where in fact students come in specialized. Right? They already come in with a subject that they're choosing, they've chosen. The idea behind having general education now is basically because whatever specialist kind of subject that you're trained in is unlikely to be a source of a lifelong career in any sense of the word, no matter what the subject is. So there's a sense in which there's a greater need, more than ever before, for some sort of general sense of education. And so what should be part of that general education? Now, traditionally, of course, general education has been about the humanities. And it's been about learning great literature and the great works of Western civilization and learning how to speak and to write and all of these activities, you know, the elite liberal humanist culture that has been very much debunked, I would say, certainly in the course of my professional career, usually under the guise of postmodernism, which is the period in which we live. And so the whole idea of designing general education now in this day and age is just quite a daunting one, because obviously there's a sense in which one doesn't want to get rid of speaking and writing clearly. That's still used as media of communication and producing knowledge and so forth, and not just in the elite realms. But obviously there's going to be a need for media literacy of a broader sort, and of a sort that takes into account digital technologies. And in particular, my own conception, and I'm working on this now, we haven't, so everything I'm saying is, in a sense, I'm just speaking in my own voice. I'm not speaking for Warwick University here. This is very much in the planning stages. Would be to include as one of the opportunities that students would have, would not just be to take courses that would have them read and write in relation to various sorts of classical themes, but also to be able to learn computer simulation and to engage in film projects as well, both of which would involve digital media. And we, in fact, at Warwick do have facilities that would enable large numbers of students to do that, and at the moment they're not really being taken advantage of for teaching purposes. Okay. Now, part of what's going on here, too, I think, from those of you who follow trends in higher education, is, I think, also a more general kind of concern, namely that the traditional idea that teaching and research need to be bound together tightly around disciplinary rubrics, you know, so history, sociology, economics, physics, whatever, that's breaking down. I mean, it's still valuable to have a degree called sociology as a kind of market indicator for people in the secondary schools who may have taken the subject and want to know what they should be majoring in directly. But it's not a very useful category from the standpoint of producing new knowledge, even in academic settings. And they're being able to train people who are able to operate with multiple skills, who are, in fact, more than operate with multiple skills, but be able to translate between multiple media in which knowledge is produced and communicated, is really the important thing, regardless of the subject matter. And this is the sense in which I think something like general education and this kind of renewed idea I think might be of interest to people here. One thing I should say, first of all, if you go back to the idea of general education historically, You know, and you go back to the founding of the modern university in Germany in the early 19th century, and general education was founded in philosophy, and philosophy was seen as a discipline into which all the different branches of knowledge could be translated. And so, in a sense, philosophy provided a kind of lingua franca, a sort of common medium of communication into which everything could be understood. So that was how philosophy was being understood, not as a body of knowledge itself, but as a medium of communication and transmission. And it would be something that one could write about, one could speak about, and so forth. And now it seems to me that the challenge is to be able to translate a lot of those themes that the old philosophical culture enabled us to do in the arts and the sciences over the past two centuries, to be able to do that with computer technology and film technology. That those being the new media into which these classical contents need to be translated into. And that students need to be systematically trained in this, and academics need to embrace this as part of what general knowledge and general education is. And this is kind of, I think, what the challenge is for the 21st century, at least as far as those of us who work in universities are concerned. I mean, one of the things that's very interesting, if you look in the early 19th century, one of the challenges that universities were facing was the rise of new forms of knowledge that did not fit into traditional modes of the media in which universities conducted themselves. And you have to realize that in the beginning of the 19th century, it was purely, universities were purely humanistic sites. Okay, so that everything, the only forms of knowledge that were considered adequate and worth teaching were ones that could be conveyed largely through speaking and writing. Right, and mathematics being understood that way. Okay, as a kind of way of speaking and writing. Okay, so what didn't you have? Well, you didn't, for example, have laboratories on university campuses. Right, and the whole idea of actually doing experiments with your hands, which of course had been done for a very long time prior to the 19th century, was seen as part of the manual arts, which was not something that one got a university education for. So all that stuff, you know, the heavy machinery of doing laboratory experiments, until the mid to the late 19th century was largely happening outside of university campuses. But already in the beginning of the 19th century, academics were wondering, well, look, there's this very important kind of new natural scientific knowledge being created, which universities are just not receptive to. We have to somehow be able to incorporate that into our own curriculum. Otherwise, we're going to be made obsolete. Okay, and this is what people at Oxford and Cambridge were saying, right, in the middle third of the 19th century. And so then one, but in a sense this is easier said than done, because the first step obviously is to provide the buildings and make the space and rearrange the university environment to enable big experiments to be conducted and so forth. And that's not a trivial task in its own right, because who wants their university to look like a factory? Which is in effect kind of what happened. And that was a fight in itself. But there was also this kind of more conceptual fight, which is in a way more interesting, namely, how do you make this new knowledge, you know, that's based, you know, largely around people constructing things in labs, using mechanical skills, manual arts and stuff like that, how do you translate the knowledge produced that way into something that can make sense within the traditional humanistic culture? Right? So in other words, how can we be part of a common body of knowledge? Because in a way, if you're a university, that's what your goal is. Right? I mean, it's not just to foster alternative media, but it's in some way to integrate those media so that the forms of knowledge that they produce that's very distinctive to them nevertheless feed back into some kind of general, universal form of public knowledge. That is at least the ideal to which universities aspire. And so this is a challenge that we face now. And in the 19th century, one of the interesting things from the standpoint of the intellectual history is this is the great period where people talk a lot about the so-called scientific method, which has to do with translating hypotheses into experiments. In other words, how do you take verbal statements about how the way the world works, which you may write down or you may speak or write in a philosophy book, and turn it into something that you can make a mechanical procedure out of that you can then test in some sort of concrete way and then reach a judgment on the basis of it? That's what the scientific method is about, and you get all these books, all these philosophers writing about this in the 19th century. From the standpoint of the issues we're concerned about here, this is an issue about translating knowledge from one medium to another. Okay, and that's how they, and that was the challenge that was faced in the 19th century. How do you translate this kind of, you know, linguistically based, verbally based, philosophical discourse into a medium which privileged basically manual arts? Right, was very concrete and very practical in application. And the scientific method was about that kind of translation. And it seems to me that we're going to need theories of that kind and curricula of that kind to be able to integrate all these new forms of knowledge that we're talking about being produced through digital media in the 21st century, that this is going to be a challenge for universities, and that on a regular basis, we should be training students to be alert to this, that in a sense, the kinds of things that you can do on computers, that you can do through filming and so forth, are part of general knowledge, are part of general education, and they're not, as it were, antagonistic or other or second class or first class or whatever to that traditional form of knowledge, right, but they are part of that as well. And then there's an issue of how do you translate from one medium to the other. It's not forgetting the old medium, it's translating from one medium to the other. And it seems to me this is the challenge that universities face today with regard to these matters and devising curricula that are appropriate to it. About how much more time do I have, would you say? Didn't mean to sort of catch you off base there. 10 minutes? Okay. I'm mindful of time here. Okay, one thing, in terms of the kinds of skills that one might want to think about in this... in incorporating digital media into a sort of general education program, you want to say, what's going to be the precedent? I think it's often very good to look at the history of aesthetics. Okay, aesthetics is a discipline. I'm sure you all have heard of it, if you're not practitioners of it already in some sense. Is an 18th century term. This was a term that originated with the very idea of the translation of media, translation of ideas into media, whether there are, as it were, certain ideas that can be conveyed better in certain media than others. Right? This was a kind of very pressing question during the Enlightenment. Because really, during the Enlightenment, you get a very kind of vivid sense of not only there being many different, as it were, artistic media and in competition with each other for public attention, because this is the period when the public sphere becomes a very sort of prominent entity in Europe. So you get this kind of rising middle class, which has discretionary income, which is patronizing artists and other kind of creative people in a way that hadn't really been seen before, which previously was really restricted just to monarchs and so forth. You're now beginning to get a kind of artistically supportive middle class system with lots of choices before itself, and also a rising newspaper culture that is reporting on these things and talking about these things as well. And so then the issue of judgment comes up. How does one judge the relative value of various media? Now, a very important book that came out, which I do think still bears some, is this one, Laocoon, which was a book that was published by the German dramatist and drama critic Gotthold Lessing in the 1760s. Has anyone ever heard of this? Just to get a hand count. Nobody. No, one. Okay, one. Good. So at least I'm not telling you something you already know. The idea here is Laocoon is this character from the Trojan mythology history, right? Who gets into some trouble with the gods, and eventually he and his children are encompassed by serpents, and there's a famous statue of Laocoon and his sons being engulfed by serpents, which you may have seen and not realize, a Renaissance sculpture. There's also painting of this kind that depicts this same thing, and there's also some famous lines from the Roman epic, the Aeneid, that's devoted to this. Now, the question Lessing poses is, does one of these different representations of this situation of Laocoon and his children, is one of them the best? Is there, as it were, an optimal medium for conveying this story? That's this question that Lessing poses. And Lessing's answer is that's the wrong question. Right? And this is the great moment, it seems to me, in the history of aesthetics. And this is where aesthetics often gets seen as taking off from the ground, because you realize that different media, right, convey different things. It's a very simple point, but they can do different aspects, different representations of the same object, right? And that what one needs to do is to develop judgment, to develop discretion and understanding how the different media represent things. Not necessarily to say painting is better than sculpture, which was kind of the argument that was going on at the time, right? Or that writing is, or poetry is better than both of them, which was also another kind of argument that was going on. But rather to say each represents differently, and you have to, as it were, see what's revealed and what's concealed in the process of the different kinds of representations. And as it were, judgment, the exercise of judgment, is understanding how these media work. So you have to be media literate, and this is kind of what Lessing's point was, and this was the foundation of the science of aesthetics in the 18th century Enlightenment. This was what it was about, and to be able to judge, right, is to be able to judge how the medium is representing the message. Which means you have to be medium literate. You have to understand how the medium works. And this is the thing that general education would presumably provide. It wouldn't necessarily make everybody a great filmmaker, right, or a great computer simulator, or whatever, a great computer programmer, but one would understand at least, in a very fundamental way, various principles, you might say, of selection and editing and construction, so that one understands how these things, how these representations are actually being made by the medium, so that you realize, at least, you know, the kinds of choices that have gone into this. Right? And then you, as the viewer, as the receiver, can, as it were, intelligently respond to this because you've kind of known what sort of choices the creator has made. Right? And this is where understanding how editing works is really fundamental here. And this is, of course, an issue that, you know, if you look at literary criticism, you look at the more traditional forms in which, information and knowledge is presented, this is a very important issue, right? Understanding the selection procedure, understanding the self-selection procedures that the creators and the authors go through. And so, if one is designing a general education course for understanding things in these multiple media, there would be a very strong focus on understanding how editing works. Okay, and understanding editing in particular in two kinds of ways, both of them can be covered under the word selection, but selection in two different senses. First of all, there is a selection where you actually can imagine that the creator, as it were, does this deliberately, makes certain kinds of decisions, cuts certain things out, leaves certain things in because it wants to create a specific effect. Okay, but then there's this other kind of selection. The second kind, which is much more like natural selection in biology, right? Where in a sense, all that's going on is really selecting out, right? So in other words, what one is doing is eliminating things that one doesn't want to get across, and as it were, that's the level of the editing that occurs. And then as it were, lots of other things happen as a result, right? Once the receivers and the audience get a hold of the thing. Right, so as it were, a non-directed sort of selection, which is what natural selection is in biology. Right, there's that kind of selection as well, that kind of editing as well. You know, sort of the unintended consequences of the medium by virtue of the way in which things have been presented. Okay, and it seems to me that what we, those of us like myself who work in universities, what the burden on us to do is not merely to provide the courses in these alternative media, but also to come up with some kind of theoretical understanding. You might say like almost like a unified theory of editing or something, whereby the different media by which knowledge and information are presented, right, can be understood as different aspects of the same sort of thing, even though the media themselves are really quite radically different from each other. Because I do think nowadays, especially because as was pointed out in the last talk, the adoption of new media tends to be general, tends to follow generations, right? And what that typically means, of course, is as, you know, the new generation picks up the new media, and there's a presumption that, you know, the old media belonged to the old generation, and when they die, that media dies too, or becomes irrelevant, or something of that sort. And the role of universities is to make sure that doesn't happen, right? There's a sense in which there's a kind of universality and perenniality to knowledge. As I say, knowledge continues to be relevant even after the most, even after the major contributors have kind of disappeared. But that's going to be very challenging. But I don't think it's any more challenging than what was facing academics in the 19th century when they had to somehow figure out how to translate philosophical discourses into the machinery of laboratory experiments. I mean, you know, those of you who don't do natural science experiments normally and you walk into a lab, it really does look like a factory, and it smells like a factory. And if you're someone of a philosophical background asking the big questions of, you know, why are we here and, you know, what's the nature of the universe, going into a lab as a place to resolve those issues seems incredibly strange, prima facie. But nevertheless, modern natural science is based on that idea, right? And that idea did not get off the ground in any kind of serious philosophical way until there was translations made from the old philosophical discourses into this concrete mechanical stuff that looks like a factory where laboratory experiments are conducted today. And so to me, the kinds of challenges that face us as academics in translating the older forms of knowledge into the new digital media is really no more daunting than seems to me faced the academics in the 19th century translating philosophical discourse into the sort of mechanisms and machinery of the natural science lab. And I'll stop there. Thank you.
Actually a very good segue because he is